High waves are sweeping the beaches. And there is no sign that the weather is going to improve in the next few hours. But now that we are in France, we can't stop. Now that we're in France, the reinforcements must go across. And they are going across because we've had a bulletin from England telling us that the ships on the channel form an unbroken stream, that an unprecedented wave, I think, was the way one correspondent put it. Incidentally, a naval officer who's just back from the beaches said that the weather was worse, in his opinion, during this invasion than it was at the time of the Sicilian landings, the landings on down there in Sicily in the Italian campaign. The weather was so bad that there was a great deal of seasickness among the troops. We've already learned that the casualties, thank God, have so far been very light. But there are a lot of minor casualties. A lot of the boys got bruised and banged up in those invasion craft as the large waves of the English Channel tossed the boats back and forth. Some of the boys got banged up quite a bit, and many of them were seasick. That crossing of the English Channel is a bad thing, even at best. I remember crossing it just before the war started, just a couple of days before the start of the war, and it was pretty bad even then. Now, they seem to have a foreign point here.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, NBC takes you to Australia. The report comes to you by way of San Francisco.
This is an excited country today. Crowds of people cluster around radios and at newsstands to talk invasion. Thousands of toasts to victory were raised in Sydney bars last night, even though liquor is scarce. Churches opened their doors for extraordinary services. All today, prayers are being said in nearly every church. All Catholic churches are celebrating special masses. A service is taking place in Sydney's largest synagogue at this moment. The news broke at dinner time last night, and I don't suppose a single Australian family talked of anything else at the table. Now it's just after lunch on Wednesday. It's a cold winter day, 42 above zero, and crowds are scudding back to work. Work that may be a bit slighted in the drama of the moment. And yet Sydney is not hysterical. Everybody has commented on the sober, prayerful way Australia has taken the news. That perennial barometer, the taxi cab driver, had his say. One cabbie told me that this means the war in Europe may be over in a few months, and reverently he added, with God's blessing. But a Royal Australian Air Force officer said to me at breakfast this morning that the country expects many casualties. Plenty of Australian airmen are in Britain, and everybody dreads that cost of victory. The acting Prime Minister, Francis Ford, called this the greatest event of the war. Complete success, he said, will bring the defeat of Germany within measurable distance. Today's newspapers reflect Australia's feeling. The biggest paper, the Herald, said Australia and the world have waited for this day since Hitler drove into Russia. Australia will feel its deep kinship, the Herald added, with Britain and America and their allies. The newspaper said what all Australia is thinking, that as the fortunes of battle favor the Allied invasion armies, prospects in the Pacific will alter to our advantage. Australia knows that when Germany is defeated, and only then, can we throw our main weight against Japan. But Australia hopes and believes that this will not mean that our own Pacific offensive will be slighted. This country will always regard Germany not as a secondary, but as a less immediate enemy. And Australia is pledged to keep the food and raw materials moving to our bases in Europe. That's how Australia feels as her people fasten their coats against bitter winds as they remember fondly what eggs for breakfast were like and resolve to do with less butter and meat and tomato juice. They know they've a part in victory over Hitler, just as they've so nobly fought for victory over Japan. Australia feels close to America and Britain today, and her people, 7 million of them, will support their allies with everything they have. There's hope, confidence, even exultation. And there are prayers that too many boys may not be sacrificed, that too many months will not go by before unconditional surrender. This is William Kelty speaking from Australia. We take you now to NBC in Honolulu.
This is Robert McCormick in Honolulu. One aspect of the European invasion that interests us out here in the Central Pacific is what our troops will find when they penetrate more deeply into Hitler's Europe. What observers out here particularly want to know is how much damage has been done to Germany's industrial empire by our intensive bombings. Most of us have always taken it for granted that Japan will someday be subjected to the same terrific bombing attack that we've been giving Germany. We've even thought perhaps Japan will take a worse beating from the air than Germany has. Because by the time we can open up on the Jap mainland, we should have even more and even better bombers than we have now. The popular idea has been that Tokyo, well, indeed most of Japan, will go up in smoke under heavy bombing. But some of our top military men out here do not agree. They think Japan's more important industrial areas are modern and extremely well built, and will be at least as hard to knock out as Germany's critical industries and defenses. But when we get into Germany, we can see how much damage our bombings have actually done, and then we'll be better able to tell what we can do to Japan. We've already had some good samples on a small scale of what bombing can do to the Japs. Our raids on the Jap islands and the Marshalls show we've hammered them into what borders on uselessness. In some ways, they've been even more thoroughly devastated than was Pantelleria, the little Mediterranean island that surrendered to Allied bombers. But these are far removed from the massive, widespread bombings we'll someday have to give the Jap mainland. The only true test of large-scale bombing has been in Germany, and we out here are very anxious to learn the results. Also, the fighting in Europe is an unprecedented test of large-scale amphibious operations. The 5th Amphibious Corps out here, the spearhead of the war against the Japs, is extraordinarily skillful in amphibious fighting. But they haven't yet tackled a job as big as that we're trying to do in France. The French invasion is much more nearly what we'll someday have to do on the coast of China or on the Jap mainland. Another possible wrinkle in the European invasion that intrigues us here is the question of what will happen to Japanese morale if we are spectacularly successful in France. It would leave Japan with the prospect of standing all by herself to face the greatest mass of fighting power the world has ever seen. She would face two of the greatest nations in the world, certainly, Britain and the United States, and possibly a third tremendous power, Russia. Surely not even Japan could fool herself for long about how such a lopsided fight would come out. And one other thing, the European attack is the climactic test of our troops in land fighting against the best the enemy has. And we're very interested to see how our troops stand up in the tightest pinch they've ever been in. This is Robert McCormick in Honolulu switching you to NBC in Washington.
We take you now to NBC in Washington.
The president told the nation only a short time ago that the invasion has come to pass with success thus far. Then, in reverential tones, the commander-in-chief beseeched God to give strength and victory to our fighting forces. Well, Mr. Roosevelt's word that the invasion is a success thus far indicates the attitude of our high command here in the Capitol. So far, as Washington sees it, we have achieved our first objective. We have succeeded in making our landings on the continent of Europe. So far, so good. But from the military men to whom I've talked today, they say, let's wait for the fateful hour of decision, which will come in about a week. By that time, the Nazis will have had time to assess our full power and our main striking position. And then will come the real hour of crisis. The crisis not only for the Nazis, but for the Allied force of General Eisenhower as well. So by next Tuesday evening, a week from this historic D-Day, perhaps we will have another report from the Commander-in-Chief. A report expanding on his statement this evening that our invasion is a success thus far. Well, Mr. Roosevelt's prayer this evening reflects the spirit, as I find it, with which all of Washington is receiving the invasion news. General George C. Marshall, the chief of staff of our invading army. Admiral Ernest J. King, our chief of naval operations, called at the White House today to make a personal report. And then Mr. Roosevelt, calm and serene, held his press and radio conference as usual. Well, virtually all of Washington's churches held special services throughout the day. At Washington's Episcopal Cathedral here, services were held every hour on the hour. And this evening, prayers for victory were said at St. Matthew's and at St. Patrick's. Well, but by and large, Washington, whose chief business is government, went about its occupation as usual today. Now, most of the work, of course, is connected with the war. Touching on the home front, a special House committee heard Sewell Avery, the chairman of Montgomery Ward, attack the seizure of his big mail-order plant in Chicago. But this evening, Mr. Avery received his answer from the government. The War Labor Board ordered Montgomery Ward to extend its controversial contract with the CIO Union. Oh, in effect, the Labor Board is only inviting a repetition of this bitter feud between management and labor. And again, this evening, the State Department reveals that we won an important diplomatic victory immediately prior to our invasion of France. Acting Secretary of State Edward Stettinius tells us that neutral Portugal has agreed to stop all shipments of tungsten to Germany. So Hitler will have even less tungsten now to harden his steel for weapons. And the Federal Bureau of Investigation steps into the war news. J. Edgar Hoover, the head G-man, warns his organization that the invasion may bring an attempt at enemy sabotage on the home front. But even on D-Day, we can't get away from the fact that 1944 is a campaign year. Now, there were two special congressional elections today in New York City. A Democrat won one, and a Republican the other. The Republican victory came in a district which has gone Democratic for the past 25 years. But to me, the biggest invasion story in Washington today is one reported by my wife. She was shopping this afternoon in a big downtown department store. She was standing at a counter looking at ladies' blouses. Well, a middle-aged woman stepped up and asked the sales girl if she might see some blouses, too. The sales lady brought out several. But suddenly, this middle-aged woman put them down on the counter. "I'm sorry," she said, "but somehow I can't go on. You see, I have three sons fighting in France today." And that was D-Day, June 6, 1944, in Washington. I return you now to Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York.
Well, I'm glad we got Washington and Honolulu for you, so our pickups aren't a complete failure. Here are several bulletins that have come in while Dick Harkness has been talking to you. The French beaches across which the Americans drove today were selected many months ago, we now learn. Only recently did the Germans seriously start to build up defenses there, and nevertheless, the attack found them far less heavily gunned and fortified than the great port areas in Denmark, the Netherlands, Belgium, and the rest of France. A German military spokesman is quoted tonight as saying that not even walls of burning oil could stop the waves of Allied attackers which stormed the bristling heart of the Atlantic Wall. That from a German. Tito's partisans are on the move tonight. They've opened an accelerated offensive in Yugoslavia to coincide with Allied landings in France. They have captured six towns from the Germans. As you may have heard before, today more than 150 soldiers, mostly Americans, were received by Pope Pius in a surprise audience. The soldiers had gathered before St. Peter's and asked for an audience with the Pope, but they hadn't really expected to get it. By the way, be sure and keep tuned to your NBC radios for something very special immediately after this broadcast. Well, that's the news up to 11:30 p.m. Eastern Wartime, and this is Robert St. John saying good night.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
The great offensive has begun. With NBC, Invasion News has the right of way over all programs. Bulletins will be broadcast as they come through. Keep listening to WEAF, New York.